The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Going, going, gone! Private investors are heading to commercial property auctions, so we tagged along to see if it really is a viable alternative to buy-to-let. Has oil hit bottom and started to bounce back? Our adventurous investor David Stevenson drops into the studio to say why he's dripping more money into resources stocks. And last but not least, BBC Moneybox presenter Paul Lewis will be giving us a maths lesson on why new auto-enrolment pensions don't quite add up. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's most popular weekly podcast. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues and columnists. As the Chancellor continues his crackdown on residential buy-to-let investments, could private investors make more money from buying a commercial property like a shop or a small office building instead? Many investors enter the sector via commercial property auctions, and I'm joined in the FT studio by James Pickford, Deputy Money Editor, who recently attended a big sale and has written all about his experiences for our cover feature this week. James, thanks for joining us today. So you survived the auction and sat on your hands all the way through to avoid bidding for a high street shop by accident. But what kind of investors did you meet and why do they like commercial property?
That's right. I managed not to scratch my eyebrow at any point during the proceedings. But yes, it was a very interesting, diverse crowd of investors. There were retired people thinking of something to do with their savings. There were property developers. There were people bidding on behalf of others, clearly with money to invest. There were overseas investors, it appeared. And they are all interested in investing in something which gives them a steady stream of income. In an ideal world where you have a reliable commercial tenant who writes them 4 checks a year. These come in. There is much less to be done than there typically there would be with a buy-to-let investment in terms of maintenance and so forth. So once they get into it, it's a pretty attractive investment.
Now, commercial property investors talk about the tax advantages, which have changed recently. What are they?
Well, we've spoken on the FT Money podcast about the introduction of a new surcharge to stamp duty on second homes and buy-to-let. Mm. That isn't applicable on commercial property. So that just came in April the 1st. So that's one way in which it differs from residential investment. But also, the Chancellor has announced that from 2017... buy-to-let investors, their tax relief on mortgage interest payments will be limited. But that won't be the case for investment in commercial property. And likewise, you can put commercial properties into private pensions, into SIPs, essentially, which you can't do with residential.
No, you
so
can't.
There are a number of tax advantages there.
So lots of things to think about. Why aren't more people doing it?
Well, often people don't want to take a lot of income in the year. They might like the fact that if they invest in residential property, they get slightly less income and more capital growth.
Which for now, yeah.
Exactly. So, and that's because if you do get a lot of income in, it pushes you into a higher tax bracket. But also, it's a completely different kind of ball game. This is made clear by everyone I've spoken to on this. When you invest in a residential property, the value of the property resides in its vacant possession. But with commercial property, so much is tied into the quality of the tenant, the lease you have. How long is it? How reliable is it? What break clauses are there? Are those checks going to be reliably coming in year after year? And the capital growth in commercial property has been patchier, much less reliable than in buy-to-let residential.
Yeah, and certainly in your piece you talk also about the hidden dangers of business rates which fall back to the landlord if the shop lies or office lies empty. Now, one investor that you met at the auction told you a fascinating, if somewhat dubious, tactic from days of old involving a tube of superglue. Explain.
Well, this is what we call sailing close to the wind. This is a property developer who would go seeking out attractive properties that were coming up for auction. He would go and view them. And we're talking a long time ago here, sort of the 90s. And so once he'd seen a property he liked, he would, if he was on his own or if he wasn't, he would come back later and put a little bit of super glue into the lock so that other people could would have trouble seeing it. And maybe the agent or would take a little while to figure out what was going on, by which time it was too late. And everyone would be rather surprised at auction when only one or two people put their hands up for the property. But this does bring me onto the issue of how important it is to go and see a property before you bid for it at auction. And with commercial property, it often is at auction that that people buy these properties. So that can be quite difficult often, especially if a property has come onto the market by a business going into administration. It's much harder and there's less time to get in there. But it's really important that you look at the condition as well as all the legal aspects of the lease and the economic aspects. Is the property in the right place in the high street? Does it have car parking? Is it close to transport networks? How attractive is it for a business, and ideally a big national brand name business, to go in there and really commit to that property?
And two important words to remember, listeners: caveat emptor, buyer beware. You can't recourse to the auctioneer after the sale if you later find out there's something wrong with the property. So thanks there to James Pickford. You can read his full cover feature, which lifts the lid on commercial property auctions, in FT Money this weekend. Still to come on the FT Money show, is auto-enrolment all it's cracked up to be? Before that, let's go back to black. David Stevenson, FT Money's adventurous investor columnist, argues this week that it's time for investors to consider inching back into some risky sectors, including oil. David, welcome to The Money Show.
Hello, Claire.
I'm going to start off with a very simple question. Oil, is it time?
Look, I mean, do I think oil prices will probably carry on going down to about 35 or 30 after this weekend's Doha conference, where the oil community singularly failed to get an agreement on cutting supply because of the absence of one of the key players? Yes, I think oil prices will probably go a little bit lower. Do I think that we're in a trading range now, which is about 25, maybe 30, 30 to 25 to about 45? Yes. And that's what really matters, is that we might have found the bottom. Yeah. And the bottom probably, I'm guessing, might be about 27, 28. And what that matters for investors is, look, do I think if you've got a large amount of capital, should you just go wading into oil stocks and just go for it now? No. Inch in and drip feed money in, because the bottom of the cycle is clear. We're beginning to see a massive wave of capitulations of big corporates in the US. There's a big US professional services firm that does an analysis of bankruptcies, and we're at peak level bankruptcies at the moment. And it's typically at these moments when distress is at maximum levels and the corporate restructuring and M&A deals are happening that you get the most interesting equity plays. So now is the time to start investigating, because you sort of know the range.
Now, you suggest some specific plays in your column. Tell us briefly about them.
Well, I've already written a column a couple of months ago just about some UK plays that are out there. And one of the things I was looking at in particular was companies which are unencumbered with debt. And I do think that's still a very important thing. And I think most of those stocks have done fairly well. So I think the next step is to have a look at big US unconventional oil and gas plays that have got fantastic reserves and are going to survive the long winter, even though we're coming into summer, the long winter in economic terms of the US unconventional oil and gas industry. And I mentioned a couple of stocks in there, which if people read the column, they'll be able to find out about. And they're both quality players who've got big acreages in the big unconventional plays. So that's usually around the Appalachian Mountains. And then there's the Permian Basin, and there's a bunch of stuff in the Midwest. A lot of these guys have been buying massive, massive acreages. Now, that industry is not going away. That industry is going to rationalize. That industry is going to have a high cost of capital. There's going to be merger and acquisitions, boom, there's going to be rationalization. And really what you want to be is you want to be in the stocks that have got the biggest, best assets with half decent balance sheets, because those are the guys who are going to be tomorrow's majors. And so I've got some suggestions there. And also, more generally, I think we're beginning to see the emergence of some fund managers opportunistically launching funds for kind of energy recovery stories. So the fund which I talk about again, which is in the column this weekend, is a manager I've known for many years. He was in another very successful series of investment trusts, and he's launched an oil opportunistic oil recovery fund. And I think the point about it is you've really got to know your stocks, yeah, and you've really got to know with the quality management, good balance sheets. And therefore, if you can find a fund that is opportunistically playing in this space, now is the time to probably start putting money into it. That's not to say that the existing funds that are out there, and there's a couple of them out there, Artemis and Guinness, they both have a global energy fund. They'll do a good job for you as well, because you've got good managers who sort of know what they're doing and stock picking.
OK, well, thanks very much. That was David Stevenson, the FT's adventurous investor columnist, and you can read his full column now on ft.com/money or in FT Money this weekend as part of the Weekend FT, widely available on both Saturday and Sunday. Now, time for a maths lesson. The new legal requirement to opt in most employees into a workplace pension scheme, known as auto-enrolment or AE, is a policy designed to minimise the pension shock that future generations will face if they fail to save enough for retirement in later life. I'm joined by Paul Lewis, the journalist and presenter of BBC Radio 4's Moneybox programme, who has been busy with his calculator to see if those numbers really add up. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Claire.
In your column for FT Money this week, you're quick to say that you're not against the principle of auto-enrolment, but you think that some of the headline numbers being bandied around are misleading.
Yes, I think they are. It's hard to be against auto-enrolment because everybody's paying into a pension, and of course, with the new rules, they'll be able to take it out and do what they like with it once they're in their sort of mid to late 50s. So that's all good, but I think the government particularly is guilty of misleading us by saying that, for example, when this is fully phased in a couple of years, 8% of pay will be going into the pension. As I say in the column, 8% is actually 100% wrong.
Yes, now talk us through that figure.
Well, it's 8% of a band of earnings. Instead of 8% of your whole pay, it's 8% of a band that begins at £112 a week, that's about £5,800 a year, and then it goes up to the higher rate tax threshold, £43,000 a year. So because it's 8% of that band, and it's not 8% of anything below £5,800, it's not 8% of your whole pay. And if you do the calculations, it's very striking. The very, very most that could go in is 6.9%. And for people on, for example, the new so-called national living wage, if they work 40 hours a week, which most of them work slightly less than that, it'll only be 4.9% of pay going in. And someone at the very bottom end, on £10,000 a year, £193 a week, is just over 3% of their pay. Now, you're not going to get a decent pension for those tiny amounts.
No, and particularly seeing as this is a scheme designed to catch lower income workers who aren't paying into a fully fledged company pension scheme, which brings me on to your second criticism, which is to do with the division of what the employee pays in compared to what the employer then tops it up by. Tell me your working out.
Well, in the past, it's always been the case that the employer, the boss, if you like, always pays in much more than the employee, the worker. If you look at really good schemes, like that pay you a pension related to your salary, the boss is paying in nearly 16% of your pay and the worker about 5%. But in this auto-enrolment scheme, that is completely reversed. I mean, the amounts obviously are much smaller, but the key thing is the employer, the boss, is paying in 3% and the employee is paying in 5%. And those, of course, are lower than that for the reasons I gave earlier, but those are the nominal amounts. So the division switches round. It's the worker who pays in the biggest share and the boss who pays in the smaller share. And that seems to me to be undermining the principle of pensions, which is really it's deferred pay. So the person who's paying you should be paying in the most.
Indeed, and something that most people probably won't find out until decades have gone past and they realise there's less in their pension pot than they perhaps hoped. But the final lesson of your column, however, is that if you are auto-enrolled into a pension, in most cases, you should stick with it.
Well, yes, stick with it because, I mean, look, you're getting tax relief, so the taxpayer's making a bit of a contribution. You're getting your employer's contribution, which may not be as big as I'd like, but at least it's there. So you're only paying in about half, maybe, personally, out of your taxed income, what goes in. So whatever you get out is going to be a bonus. And, of course, nowadays, under pension freedom, once you're in your mid to late 50s, you'll be free to take the whole lot out if you want, so you can get it back and you've got this tax advantage of paying it in. But anyone who thinks that auto-enrolment payments are going to get them a decent pension is, I'm afraid, fooling themselves. It won't, but at least it will give you something that can help you a bit towards your retirement.
Well, thanks very much. That was, of course, Paul Lewis, and you can read his full column now at ft.com/money and in FT Money this weekend. We'd love to know what you think about buying commercial property at auction, the potential resurgence of resources stocks, or about money matters more generally. You can get in touch with us via email, our address, money@ft.com, or you can tweet us at ftmoney, and you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else will feature in FT Money this weekend. Our fund manager's spending too much of your money on the golf course. We investigate. And the tax man received top billing after a landmark legal victory against film tax avoidance schemes last week. We pore over the details. Plus, we have the latest share tips and director's deals from the Investors Chronicle. The Money Show was produced and edited in London by Adam Palin. We will be back next week at our new regular publication time of 6 a.m. on Thursday mornings, London time, ready for your commute into work. But now, it's goodbye from me and our studio guests. Goodbye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.